Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. And it's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Because it's a jokey time. And coming up in just a couple seconds here, we've got the Monday morning movie reviews. Colin Suter is taking a little time off. He's doing some school stuff. So Jim Laskowski is going to be filling in for him for the next couple of months. So that's who's going to be with us. It'll be Jim and Eric to review all the new movies. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And we're going to be talking about biopics a little bit later on and as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right, let's get right to it. We got some movies to talk about and the box office. Eric will stick around and we'll talk box office. Some interesting numbers about that coming out as well. So let's get to welcoming these guys. Here's Eric. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. We got some movies to get to. So why don't we start with Eric? Why don't you tell us about Bodied?
Okay, Bodied is a film that premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in 2017 and became a little bit of an instant sensation on the festival scene. Everywhere it seemed to play, it kind of popped up at Sundance. Everyone who went in and came out of the thing talked about, you know, just what an unbelievably energetic, lively film this was. So much so that we ended up programming it at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and it's the story of a young college student who's looking, he's doing a thesis on rap battles. So as the film opens, he and his very disapproving girlfriend are going to sort of witness a rap battle and want to learn more about it from one of the sort of the rising stars, or one of the current stars on the rap battle scene, if you will, a character known as Ben Grimm, spelled differently than the Fantastic Four character, of course. So they end up sort of forming a bit of a friendship when the kid seems to know what he's actually talking about and actually turns into kind of a bit of a good rapper himself. So they end up sort of touring around, going to different places where rap battles take place, and all of a sudden this kid finds himself participating in them themselves and just becoming a bit of a rising, unexpected star himself. The thing is that one thing, if you've ever seen rap battles, they don't turn out to be the most politically correct of things. And so this is a movie that then begins to explore the very nature of political correctness as seen through the eyes of different races and cultures and you know, lifestyles and things, classes. And it's a film that is so energetic. It is so full of just these lively rap battles. And you know, when I talk about rap battles, I mean, that's not a term that flows frequently off my tongue. It's not something that I'm particularly have a great interest in. I was not a fan of 8 Mile, and I'm not really astute in the rap world. But this is a film that has something much larger to say than just giving us, you know, these wonderful you know, exchanges, you know, between these contestants. They're really trying to get at something here about you know, what exactly our culture has been going through, you know, particularly recently. But you know, you see the seeds of it, the things that we have been going through for so long, just the nature of how far we can go with our speech. You know, where does someone cross the line? And it's a film that has shifting loyalties to it. The main character is one that we, you know, at one point we're rooting for, and the other point we are entirely rooting against. It is sort of the disintegration of this character, not because of the culture that he ends up investing himself in, but just the nature of humanity, that, you know, we're predisposed to go down these routes if we don't learn, you know, exactly the history from where these horrible phrases and things come from. And it's like I said, I mean, this is as lively a movie as you're going to see this year. It is incredibly funny at times. It is meant to make you uncomfortable, and gloriously so. And it really is, when I walk out of this thing, I never expected a movie about rap battles to be one of my favorite movies of the year, but Bodied absolutely is.
Wow, okay. That's playing at the River East exclusively. If you want to see it, it's at the River East downtown. So, okay, that's Bodied. All right. Jim, why don't you tell us about Wildlife?
Happy to. Yeah, it seems to become reviewing a lot of movies that are written and directed by actors, because not only is this Paul Dano's directorial debut, but he has also co-written the script with Zoe Kazan, and it's been adapted from a book by author Richard Ford. It's set in the 1960s, and it tells the story of a family in Montana. We mainly view the world through the eyes of young Joe, and he is about 14 or so, a little bit reserved, but also a good student, and is encouraged to achieve more by his parents. Father is played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and mother, Jean, is played by Carey Mulligan. So when Jerry is fired from his job at the golf course, he sort of spirals into a little bit of a midlife crisis, or even a mild depression of sorts, which brings out the cracks, I guess, in the already sort of vulnerable marriage that the two are experiencing. And then he has, on top of it, dwindling finances. So Gene is forced to take up teaching swimming classes at the Y, and son Joe decides to pitch in by taking up a part-time job with a photographer. Ultimately, Jerry decides to go and fight wildfires near the Canadian border to instill some sense of purpose in his own life, which leaves Gene quite distraught at the thought of being alone. And so then Joe has to go out and, you know, take care of his own personal life out there in the wild. And then mother is, sort of struggling and impulsively, but understandably, is driven to another man, played by character actor Bill Camp, as she sort of strives to break free of her roles as mother and wife. And then we witness the effects of family strife and fragility, with each person coping differently as things begin to spiral out of control. So will this family be able to work out things, and does Gene need to move forward, and how will son Joe sort of cope with all this? Is kind of what we get to experience here. So yeah, as I mentioned at the top, that last week we reviewed mid-90s, which I wasn't crazy about, as well as What They Had, both of which were written and directed by actors, and it seems like that's kind of happening a lot lately, and this is one of the better examples, Wildlife here. So I think the appeal of a lot of these films is watching these incredible actors portraying very, very memorable characters. And obviously domestic dramas like this in particular are kind of a dime a dozen. So something like this really needs to sort of stand out to distinguish itself from other films about rocky marriages. But this is one of them. And the actors here sort of just disappear into their roles and keep you invested in their characters. I know some audience members at early screening sort of viewed Carey Mulligan's character as Gene as kind of like this hopelessly cruel and selfish character, but I didn't have that experience. I mean, I think the screenplay showcases a lot of dimension to her. I mean, she makes choices and makes mistakes like real people, and she certainly makes some rash decisions and potentially damaging choices. But at the same time, I think, you know, she means well, and she's trying to at least become a fully realized individual while also trying to be, you know, supportive for her son. And I think we have a lot of sympathy for her, and, you know, I just think someone like Carrie Mulligan keeps her grounded and very sympathetic. I think this might be Carrie Mulligan's best role since maybe her first with an education. And Dano here, I mean, he shows a lot of restraint and sensitivity in his debut. And it's clear that, you know, working with a lot of our very best directors, he's learned a lot. Cinematography is great. There are some really photogenic, gorgeous shots capturing a part of the country we don't normally get to see. And the men here are very well observed as well. So I think this is a great film. It's more for the performances than anything else, but I think it's very special. And this one gets a high recommendation, and I hope Mulligan gets some well-deserved awards attention at the end of the year because it's quite good.
Okay. All right. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up here, and then when we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of Wildlife, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Wildlife as well. Monday morning movie reviews will continue right after the news, which is next on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning here till 5 a.m. I'm here. I'm your overnight dude. Weekday mornings, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And for talk and text, we've got a bunch of stuff we're going to be talking about. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning. And in honor of Bohemian Rhapsody being released, we are going to talk about biopics, some of the best and maybe some of the worst. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And there you go. We are reviewing the new movies as we do every week. Jim Laskowski is filling in for Colin Suter for a while. And Eric Childress is here. They're both here. And we're in the middle of reviewing movies. And then after we finish the reviews, Eric and I will talk about the box office results for the weekend. So let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Eric, you tell us what you thought of Wildlife.
Yeah, this was one of my very favorite movies from Sundance this year. And, you know, talking about an environment that, you know, Jim sort of hinted at, that the idea that, you know, these movies might seem like a dime a dozen, that certainly can be true at Sundance. But, you know, Paul Dano does some remarkable things with this film, not the least of which is its casting. I echo Jim's sentiments that I think this is Carrie Mulligan's best performance to date. And that's saying something. I mean, you mentioned An Education, which was, I also saw at Sundance, and that was sort of her breakthrough role. But, you know, this is such a rich character, and you see, like, her entire history of this character in her face at times throughout this movie. You know, people want to deem her a selfish character. That's fine, I suppose. But I think that this is a character that is exploring the opportunity to be selfish for the first time in her life. And you know, there's some movies that, you know, gain a greater power because of the time in which they are born in. And, you know, Zoe Kazan obviously is a very, very voiceful activist, out there. And this is a movie, you know, about a woman in a particular time. Not to say that Jake Gyllenhaal's character is not sympathetic. He is, throughout the movie. But you know, you question her decisions at times, but you never, at no point do you ever feel distanced from her. You know, you want you know the best for this family, and not a lot is being said about Ed Oxenbold, who plays the boy in the film. I think he gives a wonderful performance. You know, right up to, you know, the sort of the discoveries that he's making in his own life, and up to, I think, the kind of the perfect final moment of this film. It's a movie that I haven't seen since Sundance. I'm very much looking forward to revisiting this before we start filling out our ballots. But I'm pretty sure Carrie Mulligan is going to be on mine, and other areas on my ballot might be filled by this movie as well.
Yeah, this is great stuff, man. Great stuff. And a really, really strong debut as a director from Dano. The three of us could just sit here and talk about Carey Mulligan all morning. Seriously, because she's astonishing in this movie, and she's such a great actress. And again, Eric, I agree with you. I think it's the best role she's ever had, and that's saying a lot because she's been great in a lot of great movies. But this is a really amazing performance. All the performances are good. I'm glad you mentioned the kid too, because he's very good as well. I cared about the characters, but Jake Gyllenhaal is usually very, very good, and he's got a really interesting and complex role here. The whole like marriage in trouble thing has been done a million times, as we've mentioned before. And I think that this movie has a lot of power to it, and I think is, as you said, Eric, is released at a pretty important time for a movie about like about this subject matter. But I think Dano makes a great directorial debut. I thought the screenplay adaptation by him and Zoe Kazan is really wonderful and complex and interesting. And the cast here is just superlative. I mean, it's a joy to watch these people act with such strong material, and in particular Carey Mulligan. I think she has to be nominated for an Academy Award for this role. She must. I mean, is she a favorite, Eric? You think?
I don't know. I haven't examined the race too closely yet, and IFC is releasing this movie, and yeah, they've been able to get some people in. I mean, Boyhood was a big success for them, some years ago.
Yeah.
But these independent studios like IFC and Magnolia. I mean, look how hard we were campaigning for Harry Dean Stanton last year for Lucky.
Yeah.
And Magnolia, didn't even make a ripple. Last year, I think there'll be more calls for Carey Mulligan this season, and I think you will see her name pop up in some critics' awards and nominations and things like that. And hopefully, that will translate to something. So, I mean, if the critics keep her name in the conversation, then she has a legitimate shot.
Well, I'll be keeping her name in the conversation. I can tell you that right now,
so will I.
Because it's one of my favorite performances of the year, and she is. She's just great in it. I mean, really, really great. And it's a really, really strong film. So all the way around, man, I think this is a terrific piece of work. And I'm really happy for Paul Dano. He's a guy I like, as an actor.
Yeah.
And now I like him as a director. So nice job all the way around. And again, Carey Mulligan, amazing. So that's Wildlife. Three strong, very strong yeses for Wildlife. So there you go. All right. Now, by the way, none of us saw the Tyler Perry movie. called Nobody's Fool with Tiffany Haddish. We'll talk.
But when he starts screening them for critics, I'll start going to see him.
Yeah. we'll talk about that in the box office coming up a little bit later on. Eric, you actually did go see The Nutcracker in the Four Realms.
Yeah.
Is it as good as the Andre Konchalovsky masterpiece from a few years ago?
Well, I mean, define good. when you bring up that film, you have to qualify it with why we're fascinated with that movie. Because I was at an event last night where someone said this one is actually way worse than that version. I think that's a bit of an overreach. If I might say so, but at the same time, I would rather watch the Andre Konchalovsky version because it is so insane and so wrong and so bad and such an unbelievable failure. The Nutcracker in the Four Realms is Disney's new version of, their reimagining or whatever it might be of the Nutcracker ballet. And it basically, it's Disney, just basically doing it in the Alice in Wonderland, Alice through the Looking Glass, Oz the Great and Powerful milieu. This is a movie that, the young girl played by Mackenzie Foy, who played the young, she played, Matthew McConaughey's daughter in Interstellar.
Right.
Okay, so, high praise already there. And she stars as a girl who gets a present from her late mother on, I think it's Christmas or I guess. And it's just like this golden egg, and it has to be opened. She doesn't know how to open it. Thankfully, her godfather is played by Morgan Freeman, and he's an inventor and a locksmith and stuff, and he's got the necessary key. She gets transported to the world of the Sugar Plum Fairies, played by Keira Knightley, and Mother Ginger or whatever, played by Helen Mirren. And it's just it's another story of a girl transported to a magical land and has to be the savior of the magical land from the people who are trying to overtake it. So that's about the best thing I can say about this movie is that I was just absolutely disinterested in it. If ever a movie is just constantly leaning on its costumes and art direction and occasional special effects to tell its story, it's this one, because there's nothing involving about this at all. I mean, it's funny enough, it's the second movie this week that we're going to be talking about where the familiar themes in the soundtrack transport you to better times. Hearing bits and pieces of the Nutcracker Suite and all the famous chords that we're familiar with in that ballet, it kind of takes us back to whether it be Fantasia or Caddyshack or whatever it might be. It takes you to another place. It's just like, okay, I like this. Let's stick with this. And there's like, no, it's just we're going to have, little CGI mice and, soldiers and Keira Knightley, doing Dark Crystal stuff. I don't know. I sat there with this kind of glazed expression, I think. If someone was, there was a camera on me, I don't know if I ever changed my expression. I just sat there just kind of like squinting at it. And, like, what am I supposed to care about here, precisely? Because I don't even know if the movie really does. And it's kind of indistinguishable from those other movies, except that, like, Sam Raimi and Tim Burton would occasionally make you feel like they cared about the material a little bit. I mean, I think Alice in Wonderland is, maybe Tim Burton's worst film, maybe. But, at least Sam Raimi with Oz the Great and Powerful, had some images and some sequences and got performances that, at least kind of kept you in the game. This one has nothing to keep you in the game. It's just a series of sets and costumes and occasional special effects that is just not worthy of anyone's time. You're better off just listening to an album of the Nutcracker.
I happen to be a huge fan of Oz the Great and Powerful. I know you guys know that. I just think it's a great film. I'm interested in the directing credits here. Is there a behind the scenes story as to why it's credited to both Lassie Hallström and 3-star Joe Johnston?
Yes, there is actually. Lassie Hallström was the original director on the film, and he completed it, and then they wanted to do special effects reshoots, and he was not available to do it. So they brought in Joe Johnston to do like a month's worth of reshoots. I mean, this movie was like initial principal photography was like finished in like 2016.
Wow.
So it's kind of been sitting out there for a while. And then Joe Johnston came in and did the month's worth of reshoots or whatever. And then they like mutually agreed to share credit on the film.
Oh, okay.
But either of them was indistinguishable.
Yeah. I mean, I knew there had to be a reason why Lassie Hallström is not the only credited director on this movie.
It shares many things in common with a movie we're going to be reviewing in a little while.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. And by the way, I think it's pretty cool that, and it says something about Christopher Nolan's casting of children, because these two kids that play McConaughey's kids in Interstellar have gone on to some pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank Christopher Nolan for casting those two kids.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is going to get, I think, nominated again this year for Best Actor.
That's very possible.
Yeah. So, all right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Jim and Eric are here. We got a couple more movies to to review, and the Monday morning movie reviews will continue after this right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18th floor of the beautiful 303 Swacker here on WGN. And it is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call up and tell a joke. Because it's a jokey time every Monday morning. And we're going to talk about biopics. That's all coming up. At 5 o'clock, you got Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And coming up, Steve Cochran at 6. And coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalvo from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. So that's all coming up here. And let's get back to the movies. Jim Laskowski is filling in for Colin Suter, as he will for the next few weeks. And Eric Childress are here. And we're talking about movies. And we'll get to the box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello again.
All right. Jim, tell us about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Wow, I never heard of this movie. Yeah. Nobody is talking about it at all on social media in any way, especially on Facebook. but yeah, well, I think most folks out there probably can guess as to the plot of this particular biopic, even if it takes some liberties with the real-life story. It's kind of a tilt-a-whirl tour through Mercury's rise and tragic end, and we briefly start at the 1985 Live Aid performance, only to go back to the beginning. We first meet young Freddie when he was known initially as Farouk, played by Rami Malek. He's the son of immigrants, and we first see him as he's working as a baggage handler at Heathrow Airport, kind of writing songs on the fly on his notepad and, you know, as a solo piano artist initially. And then eventually makes some pilgrimages out to a local club to hear his favorite band, Smile. And when that group's lead singer quits, he decides to hold his own impromptu audition in the parking lot, wowing guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor with his soaring range and uncanny ability to sort of project these incredible falsettos and gorgeous notes and harmonize instantly with his new friends in the moment there in the parking lot. And meanwhile, Freddie also meets and ultimately proposes to the love of his life, Mary Austin, here played by Lucy Boynton. And, you know, even though deep in their hearts, they know that Freddie is struggling with his own sexual identity, even if it's kind of addressed here almost as like Cliff's Notes, we sort of watch the usual rise and fall. You know, this is kind of a biopic with a capital B, and doesn't necessarily transcend beyond that. Obviously, the story has parallels to other music biopics, maybe because so many famous musicians' lives sort of follow this path. They start out struggling, they find true love, and then artistic success, struggles with stardom and touring, gets involved with drugs, losing your sense of self, growing apart from those who are close to you, and then ultimately making a comeback before a tragic end. So if we've learned anything from the clever and satirical Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, these tropes have kind of been done over and over and over again. And obviously, a story like Freddie Mercury's is absolutely worth telling in of itself. It's ripe for some kind of grand cinematic achievement. But unfortunately, here, with Bohemian Rhapsody, it follows a formula, and one that was, you know, skewered a decade ago in Walk Hard. Like, you would hope for maybe something on the level of something like Amadeus. But, again, this is a movie that is very predictable and safe, and Freddie Mercury's life was not predictable. So important moments are kind of, like, sketched out like bullet points here and are dramatized with kind of, like, this sense of duty from initially the director was Bryan Singer until he was fired from the production, at which point Dexter Fletcher stepped in to finish filming, but Bryan Singer is credited here. It's just the script has just completely embraced conventions and cliches as almost just crowd-pleasing elements. The only bright spot here really is Rami Malek's commitment and energy to the role of Freddie Mercury. I think he does a great job. And certainly the exuberant Live Aid show, which lasted 20 minutes in real life and made history, it's obviously the highlight also towards the end. So that part of it in of itself is impressive and kind of worth the wait. But really, it's kind of sad how forgettable this movie ends up being. I mean, there's a cameo by a particular actor as he listens to Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time that was more distracting and silly for me. And sitting through this it becomes kind of a chore. I felt it was like really over edited and rushed to get to certain moments. And I just don't think these filmmakers knew how to sort of encompass and encapsulate such a monumental talent. And I felt really, really restless while watching it because I knew deep down there could have been a much, much better take on this story. I even think like somebody like Edgar Wright might have been able to do this story justice in a more interesting way. So this is a subpar example of a music biopic. I cannot recommend this one, which is a huge, huge shame. Outside of Rami Malek, there's very little here to praise.
Okay. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And when we come back, we'll come back. We'll find out what Eric thought of Bohemian Rhapsody and then what I thought of Bohemian Rhapsody right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning here till 5 a.m. My dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday, and he'll be calling in with a joke a little later on in the show. We are also going to be talking about biopics and more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Here till 5 a.m., and Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning to get your work week started. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're in the middle of the movie reviews. Before the break, Jim Leskowski told us what he thought of Bohemian Rhapsody and didn't like it and is not recommending it. Jim, welcome back. And Eric,
thank you much.
Back. All right, Eric.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chime in on Bohemian Rhapsody.
Queen was the first band I ever loved. Mm-hmm. Still love them to this day. Yep. So this is a movie that I've been waiting more than 40 years for.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
I think you and I are going to have similar reviews here, Eric. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we may as well just talk together practically because I think we're on the same page on this one.
Yeah.
Because I hated this movie.
Yeah.
At parts during it, certainly afterwards, and even much more in the days since I've seen it. Jim touched. If this movie. If the worst thing you could say about this movie is that it followed the tropes that we are so familiar with in A Walk Hard, and I made Dewey Cox references in my notes when I was watching this movie.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been fine, I suppose, because at least then it would have just been on a level of a disappointment rather than an insult to the memory of Freddie Mercury. And part of that, I'm going to guess, is probably must be laid at the feet of Brian May, who was very much associated with this project, did not want Sacha Baron Cohen to do the sort of warts and all treatment that he wanted to do. And by warts and all, not that, I don't think Sacha Baron Cohen was going to insult Freddie Mercury's memory, but I think he wanted to tell the truth as much as he possibly could about a guy that, as many biographies have been written over the years, there really hasn't been anything I would call a definitive take on the life of Freddie Mercury or this band, for that matter. So it only just increases the level of hostility I have towards this movie. And it starts very early. The scene that Jim referenced about where Freddie Mercury first, tests his voice out in front of May and Taylor, and just like, oh, you know, just, wow, you hear, you know, that, you know, those falsettos, you hear how, you know, how powerful that voice is. And this movie is not interested in tackling what sets Freddie Mercury apart from his contemporaries, why his contemporaries had such a high esteem for him. In this movie, they give him one line, and it's about his teeth. Because he has extra teeth in his mouth, he has a greater range. And they pinpoint it on that one line, and that's the last you hear about it for the rest of the movie. Then the movie, you know, wants to get into his sexuality. Now, there are rumors for a long time about the production of this movie that AIDS wasn't even going to be mentioned in this movie. And, you know, I mean, it seemed ridiculous at the time, but watching this movie, it almost feels like during the reshoots, or during maybe even during the Dexter Fletcher days, that the AIDS stuff almost seems to be inserted into it, as to, like, oh, we heard the outrage, we better put this stuff in, otherwise it's going to feel, you know, that someone convinced Brian May to put this stuff in. I don't know, I'm just speculating, I'm just ranting at this point. But the manner in which they deal with his sexuality, it didn't dawn on me immediately, but as the course of the movie went through, the movie almost seems to be taking the position, whether intentionally or not, and I don't think it was intentional, but someone had to recognize that everything bad that happens to Freddie Mercury happens after he admits he's bisexual. And I think that it is so incredibly tone deaf. I mean, literally, the moment that he comes out to the love of his life, and he says, I'm bisexual, and she goes, oh, so you're gay. Okay, so immediately you have that stigma attached to it, and then they fast forward 5 years, and he's got the short haircut and the famous mustache, and he asks Roger Taylor, what does he think, and Roger Taylor says, gayer. Okay, great. Now Another One Bites the Dust is an anthem for cruising during the AIDS crisis. That's what this movie, you know, suggests that that song is. It doesn't really get into meanings of lyrics. Take a breath, Eric.
I feel your pain, my friend.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm gonna let you pick up where I leave off. But you know, it's very easy for Nick and I, you know, off air, joked about how, not so much joked, but joked a little bit about how they don't touch upon Queen's contributions to 80s cinema, particularly one great movie in 1980.
Yeah.
And then, that didn't bother me so much because I wasn't expecting that to be in the movie. Nor was I expecting there to be, you know, a great tribute to Iron Eagle, a Highlander.
Right.
But this movie doesn't, it just seemed like this movie could have been better off just making a version of the rock opera that's on stage, because the way that they use the music in the movie, they made the movie around the music rather than make a movie about the music. You know, when they get to a very particular moment in Freddie Mercury, a turning point in Freddie Mercury's life, and they actually start playing Under Pressure on the soundtrack, I groaned so loud in the theater, I almost choked.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a disaster of a movie. People who associated with it, with the exception of Rami Malek, who, you know, I will back, you know, everyone saying how good he is in the movie and the commitment that he has to it. I think at times he does lean a little too much into his teeth at times. But when he's on stage, he provides the movie with an energy that Bryan Singer and Dexter Fletcher could not bring to any of the musical moments. You know, the Live Aid performance at the end of the movie is all Malik, as far as I'm concerned, and the music. You know, anything that good happens in this movie is associated with the music. I felt really terrible leaving this movie.
Yeah. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I think it's an insult to the memory of Freddie Mercury. And completely. And I think, we're all saying that Rami Malek, he came to play. There's no question about it. He's got nothing to work with Like they gave him nothing to work with, but he is committed 1,000% to this role. And, you know, and there are times when he's really great. The last 15 minutes of the movie, you know, he owns it. But everything leading up to that is cliche after cliche after cliche, from, you know, the montage sequences, which are ridiculous. To whatever, you know, the up and down tragedy of being a rock star, whatever that is, they've made it as generic as you can possibly make it. And what's really aggravating is that Freddie Mercury was as far from generic as anyone has ever been. But they turned his life into like an ABC movie of the week, and not even that good. So just on that level, it's bad. This movie has so many ridiculous inaccuracies throughout it that I just kept getting angry while I was watching it. I'm like, that never happened. This never happened. The timeline is all screwed up. At one point in the movie, they say that they're going on their first tour and they play Fat Bottom Girls, which was not recorded until like 12 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even want to talk about the timeline in terms of what, when they were making what. The producer that worked with them, Roy Thomas, who produced a lot of their records, including Night at the Opera, when they're recording Bohemian Rhapsody, he's just reduced to some idiot sitting next to Freddie Mercury, like not even pressing buttons. And this guy's one of the greatest music producers of all time. They got a guy who played in Kenny Everett, which I thought was kind of, my favorite moment in the movie was they actually did have a reference to Kenny Everett. People might not know who Kenny Everett is, but he was a DJ who first played Queen. But he also had a comedy show called The Kenny Everett Show, which I loved and was on in the late 70s. But there's a scene with him. I'm like, oh, they got a guy playing Kenny Everett. I don't know. But here's another thing. I mean, I could just go on and on about how horrible this movie is. There is lie after lie after lie. All right. First of all, Deacon and Taylor released solo albums before Freddie Mercury did.
Mm-hmm.
He was not kicked out of the band because he wanted to go solo. That's not what happened. He never had to put a tail between his legs and go back and beg for the band to take him back. And then the most unforgivable thing about this movie, I mean, there are so many things that are unforgivable about it, is the way that they actually use the AIDS, how he contracted HIV. First of all, he tells them while they're rehearsing for Live Aid, okay, they're rehearsing for Live Aid and his voice isn't up to par. They've graciously allowed Freddie to come back into the band. Oh, God. And then, so they're rehearsing, and he tells them that he's got it, which is the line that he actually uses in the movie, which I just was, my mind was almost blown. So they tell him, now here's in real life, Freddie Mercury was diagnosed with HIV in 1987. That's 2 years after Live Aid. According to this movie, to amp up the emotion and to get him to be accepted back into the band, they say that he was diagnosed before Live Aid. That's a lie. That's absolutely a lie. And the reason why it makes me so mad is because it's this cheap way to get emotion for the last 15 minutes of the movie when you don't need that, because that performance alone is one of the greatest performances in the history of rock. One of the greatest live performances ever in the history of rock and roll. And you do not need to amp it up with a lie about when he contracted HIV. It's a bunch of crap, and it's not fair. There's so many other things in this movie that just don't make any sense. That never happened. I mean, I just can't even. And the whole Mike Myers thing is one of the most ridiculous things, and he's like the part that Mike Myers plays is not a real guy. He's a combination of like three or four different suits. So they cast him as stunt casting so that he can insult Bohemian Rhapsody and actually say, no kids would drive around in their car and bang their heads to this song. Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. So, now, here's the other thing. Now, granted, the last 15 minutes of the movie, obviously you can't argue the music. The music is Queen. They're awesome. Mm-hmm. So the best part of this movie is the music. There's no question about that. And the last 15 minutes is very impressive on how they reenacted that. And Malik is fabulous during the last 15 minutes of the movie. So, you know, and it's a cheap way to get everybody, you know, and then you see Freddy at the end. They show like real footage of Freddy. So you can walk out in a good mood because the last 15 minutes is just basically a recreation of the Live Aid performance, and then you get to see real footage of Freddy. So that's nice, but you've sat through 2 hours of crap leading up to that. And also, you know, they recreate the Live Aid footage, which is the best thing in the movie. But here's the deal. You can go to YouTube right now and watch that. So I suggest skipping this piece of crap movie. And don't listen to the lies and the inconsistencies and the inaccuracies. Just go to YouTube and watch the 20-minute performance from Live Aid. That's all you need to do. I hated this movie. Hated it. So
yeah, my one sentence review when people first asked me after I'd seen the movie what I thought about it, I said there's nothing you can get out of this movie that you couldn't get by listening to 2 hours of Queen on your iPod.
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
A disaster.
Well, I thought it was a pretty bad movie, but listening to you guys talk about it further, I think it is terrible.
Well, I mean, you know, it's unforgivable.
In
terms of what, you know, the license that they took with this guy's life and the timeline and the inaccuracies, you can't defend that. You can't defend it. It's an awful movie. All right, guys, hang on. I got to calm down.
Yeah, me too.
All right, we'll take a break.
Take a breath.
Take a break here, and we'll come back. And we got another movie to review. Before we do that. So, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. We are reviewing the new movies. Eric Childress and in for Colin Suter is Jim Liskowski. We thank him for sitting in, and let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jim, welcome back.
And thank you.
All right. Eric, care to take a crack at... describing Suspiria for everybody.
Oh man, how did I get stuck with doing this one? Oh man, okay. Well, this is the Luca Guadagnino did Call Me by Your Name. This is his remake or reimagining, however you want to call it, of Dario Argento's classic cult horror film Suspiria. And it follows, you know, in somewhat the, you know, kind of the same idea for the story. A young woman, played by Dakota Johnson, kind of a farm girl, comes to Germany to participate in a this dance school, a very kind of famous dance school that is head up by Tilda Swinton. She gets there, you know, the things, you know, around the dance school is a bit odd, you could say. There are a lot of women there. It almost feels more like a convent in a way than a dance school. The number of women that are in charge of what's going on there. But, you know, unlike the Dario Argento film, we find out very early on in this film that the school is run by a coven of witches. There's another, you know, there are a couple other dancers in the group that are a little unnerved because they don't know what happened to another former dancer played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who we see in the opening scene, basically sort of on to what's going on in this school and is relaying her thoughts to a therapist. That, you know, let's not beat around the bush, is played also by Tilda Swinton. I'm not even going to entertain that whole fake actor persona dossier that they created for that. It's Tilda Swinton in old age man makeup. Okay. So, you know, the witches coven at the dance school are, you know, sort of preparing for a ritual that's going to bring back the mother of tears or the three mothers or something like that. And Dakota Johnson's dancer might just be the key to, you know, making this finally work. Her character begins to sort of ingratiate herself. She's, you know, very skilled dancer. She knows all the moves. She listens very well and is sort of the perfect foil. And, you know, she begins to sort of like the attention that she receives. One of her sort of one of her few friends at the school, played by Mia Goth, is one of the girls who is, concerned about the Chloe Grace Moretz's character who's gone missing, and she begins to suspect that something else is going on at the school. That's probably a lot more plot
than Eric,
would ever
Eric,
be used to describe Eric, the Dario Argento.
Right, Eric, hang on a second.
Film. Okay.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski are here, and we are reviewing. We'll come back with our full reviews of the remake of Suspiria right after this on W. Welcome back. Mick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on 720 WGN. Here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call and tell the joke. 312-981-7200 is our phone number for talk and text. And we're in the middle of the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric was telling us about Suspiria. Let's bring Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, continue.
All right. So I've never been one to speak with the same kind of reverence for Argento's film that a lot of horror fans do. I've always sort of looked at Suspiria the same way that Graham Chapman looks at Camelot, which is not to say that I don't admire what it accomplishes. It's certainly a very weird, at times very spooky and unnerving film that is just kind of beautifully filmed and just kind of keeps you on edge, even though the plot makes no sense. It doesn't have much of a screenplay, and it's just kind of, random. But, a lot of really good horror films can be described in that manner. So there's something very interesting about a filmmaker tackling a project like this and taking a very simple idea, but then sort of expanding themes or just inventing entirely new ones for it. The setting, for example, the setting this, where this film is set, and sort of basking it in the kind of the post-World War II guilt of Germany and the role of that women play in society, and also the constant stories in the news about the Lufthansa, not the heist, but the hijacking of a Lufthansa plane in 1977, right? That's when the movie takes place. It's constantly, it's on everyone's minds and whatnot. So there's permutation that's going on throughout the whole film. And I didn't even mention the fact that this movie is 2.5 hours long. So this guy's really leaning into some much larger ideas and themes, all of which I think are at many times very kind of half-baked. This is a film that is just brimming with ideas. You see them falling off the screen at times. I just never felt that any of them were particularly that well developed. It seemed that every time they tried to tackle one, another one would jump in and fight for dominance at times. And there are moments in this movie that do rise to the level of that creepiness that we hope to expect from a remake of Suspiria. There's a dance rehearsal scene about 40 minutes into the film that is pretty terrific. The climax is the kind of bloody thing that you hope this movie is eventually going to lead you down after two plus hours. I wouldn't call the movie dull by any respect. I just felt that the whole thing just kind of felt kind of pointless in a way, that they've taken us through these different tangents, and it just never felt very cohesive to me. And on top of it, Dakota Johnson can't carry a scene, let alone an entire movie. So as a rooting interest in what we're supposed to be going with, I was much more interested in Mia Goth's character and even Chloe Grace Moretz, who I think is really terrific in the opening scene of this movie. But then every time they keep going back to Tilda Old Man Swinton, and, you know, the guilt that he feels for leaving his wife behind during the Holocaust, all of that just completely takes away from, you know, any sort of tension that's being built, really. I didn't really feel much for that character. Every time I see it, I'm like, okay, it's Tilda Swinton in makeup, you know? I mean, Sleuth did a better job of masking characters than this movie does. I just kind of felt just kind of hollow watching the entire thing. While, you know, Dario Argento's film was basked in colors, this movie is kind of the opposite of that for a purpose. So even it's not as visually dynamic as that movie was. And so this is a long movie. It felt very very long to me, and just ultimately was not that rewarding. Even, you know, by the time you get to the bloodshed by the end of the film, I was just like, okay, that's kind of what I expected to happen. And at the end, I was just like, oh, okay, it's over.
All right, Jim, what do you think?
This movie is bat crap crazy, and I think I loved it. It does have a lot going on, which I think it's going to take another viewing for me to completely grasp. Eric used the word unnerving in his review of the original, and I would say that's apt for both the original and this very loose remake. And, I mean, like you, Nick, I'm a fan of the original as well as a few other Argento Giallo films, and it's nothing like his work. And I think that was a pleasant surprise, to be honest. There's a far more restrained score from the great Tom York. You know, the photography is more colorless. I thought the arc of Susie was interesting, and a lot of this is just kind of flipped on its head. And I could tell the audience was pretty bewildered, and I kind of was too. But I was also really compelled by it. I mean, one of the earlier death scenes. I mean, I'm not going to give anything away. I wouldn't spoil it, but it's pretty jaw-dropping. It kind of shocked me to like few other films have outside of maybe Hereditary this year. And a lot of these sequences do go on for a while. I mean, yes, it's 2 hours and 30 minutes. It's quite long, but I didn't care. I would say that I thought most of the things on display here worked. There, obviously, we touched upon the political subtext, but also I think there is something going on late in the film about believing women that is said, that I found very relevant to, you know, more recent times, and certainly just the portrayal of conflicted motherhood and sort of the haunting uncertainties of that, along with personal trauma. And I mean, again, it's like, yes, it is like kind of a messy mashup of ideas, and the execution of it is certainly messy, but I found it really kind of audacious and really disturbing. And it's one of those movies, I think, for those who are really adventurous and want something unique out of the horror genre, I think Suspiria is really something special. I can't wait to see it again, actually. I think it's kind of great.
Yeah. All right. Now, you guys know how outspoken I've been about this. The prospect of Suspiria being remade. Suspiria, the original Suspiria, is one of my favorite movies of all time. And the scariest movie I've ever seen. I was 12 years old when I saw it. Scared the crap out of me. And I still love it. Makes no sense. The movie makes not a lick of sense. And I don't care. It's just a fairy tale freak out. And I love every frame of it. I love the way it looks and everything. So I have a huge amount of love for the original Suspiria. Now, I went in with, you know, I tried to go in with an open mind. But I gotta say, I love this movie. I love it. And I like what Guadagnino did, the angle that he took. I love that he opened it up. I mean, it's an hour longer than the original movie. And I love what he did with it. I thought, you know, taking all of these like themes about female empowerment and motherhood, and setting them against this backdrop that really is interesting. His idea, he said, was that he wanted to make a movie that felt like he felt while watching Suspiria, and I get that. I totally get that. And he didn't really do a full-on remake. I mean, you know, the plot's the same, but the plot for Suspiria is girl goes to dance school, witches. That's it. That's basically the plot. And I think a lot of the stuff that he does here is really interesting. I think Tilda Swinton is fantastic as the doctor. I think she's great. And I know it's like stunt casting, obviously, to have her in old age male makeup. And I think she's fantastic as Madame Blanc as well. She has a third part that I won't. She has a third part that I won't give away either, and that's pretty awesome. That first moment with the intercutting between Dakota Johnson dancing and what's happening in the other dance room is a stunning, I mean, shocking, unbelievable sequence, and that really kicks the movie into high gear. I thought all of the stuff was interesting. I loved those flashes of nightmare flashes during the dream sequences that they have in the movie. I think it's a really creepy movie that really gets under your skin. The length didn't bother me at all. I mean, I was unnerved during most of it, and the last 20 minutes of this movie is insane. I mean, it's just absolutely insane, and I really want to mention, I thought the wonderful small role that Jessica Harper has in this movie is great, and I love
that was nice,
and I loved her in it. It was great to see, because she's the star of the original, for people who might not know, and she's got a really important role in this movie, and I think a very emotional one. And I was with it, man. I was with it 100%, and I got to tell you, I know, Eric, you didn't like Dakota Johnson. I think Dakota Johnson's great in this movie. I think it's a great performance, and it gets deeper and more significant and creepier as it goes on. I think there's a real weird, wonderful arc that she plays in this movie. It's completely different than the character that Jessica Harper played in the original. But I was with it, and, you know, I mean, there was jaw-dropping stuff in this movie. I mean, the last 20 minutes, I was like, and I know it didn't make a lot of money over the weekend. It's not in a ton of theaters, but I can't imagine this thing not having walkouts. I can't imagine people, like, especially, like, you know, like, after the first, like, really crazy scene, you know, that's a test right there. But if you're sitting through this movie and you get to the last 20 minutes, it's the absolute insanity. I mean, I was sitting in the screening room just going, I can't even believe this is happening.
Maybe I'm just, you know, desensitized to a bit, but as bloody as it gets in those 20 minutes you referred to, I didn't feel it was that insane.
Oh, I did.
It felt like I had seen, you know, I had seen stuff like that in other movies before, and on top of it, I just didn't really care what was going on, so it was like, okay, well, that's okay, so they're just bloodying this thing up now. I don't know, I don't feel this movie is as bat crap insane as people are giving it credit for.
Okay, well, I do. I think it's nuts, and I loved it, so, all right.
Yeah, and especially coming after the Halloween remake, which did very little.
Well, it's a better movie.
It's a much better, it's not even the same ballpark, man. So, all right, next week we've got the Grinch. We've got The Girl in the Spider's Web, which I'm really, really excited about. Overlord, which looks really weird.
Yeah.
Boy Erased.
About that one.
Boy Erased and more. So that's all coming out next week. And Jim, thanks, man.
Happy to help anytime, man.
Okay,
thanks
buddy.
A lot.
Yep. Appreciate care. And then Eric, let's dive into the box office here.
Yeah.
All right. So, man, Bohemian Rhapsody made a lot of money. I did not see 50 million. I did not see 50 million coming.
I don't think I ever got to the point where I would have said 50 million coming. I mean, the reports were for the last like week or so that, you know, 40 million was very possible. I knew that this was when I made my sort of like preliminary holiday sort of box office guesses. I had Bohemian Rhapsody much lower. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what kind of interest people were going to have in this story. But then people around my age started, that it was like the top of their mind. Like, of all the movies that were coming out in the next couple months, this was the one, other than A Star Is Born, that they were asking me about.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen the Queen movie yet?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, not yet. I'm like, oh, you tell me when you see the Queen movie.
I'll tell you what, I saw it,
maybe this is going to be something.
Well, I saw it Saturday afternoon. My parents and I saw it Saturday afternoon, and we saw it in IMAX. It was packed. I knew, and people applauded at the end. So, which aggravated me because I was so I hated the movie so much. But like, no, I mean, this is a certified smash. I mean, I did not expect that.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't really touch upon all the backstory with the singer firing and all that kind of
right.
stuff. That's a whole other show, practically.
Right.
But there's something, you know, as much as we hated this movie, you know, movies about singers and bands and whatnot, you don't do this kind of business.
No, you're right.
They really don't.
Yeah.
I made a list of like all the movies that about singers that have done well, and we're talking like Pitch Perfect 2, Straight Outta Compton, and 8 Mile.
Yeah,
are like amongst the top movies, and then this beat out A Star Is Born as far as the opening is concerned. It's not going to touch Star Is Born's final number, but it's pretty huge because I mean, Walk the Line only started with $22 million, and that's like fifth or sixth on this list. So it kind of gives me a weird sense of joy that the movie did well, only because it made me happy that people are still interested in Queen.
No, that's I agree with that 100%. It's a conflict to feel that way because I hated the movie so much. But then I was like, wow, $50 million for a Freddie Mercury movie. That's awesome.
Right. It's very cool. And I don't think we're probably not, even the kind of discounting, what kind of audience this had in the gay community.
Yeah. That's true.
How
absolutely.
Many showed up this weekend is reported to be as a gay icon that he is.
That
obviously had to be a large chunk of this audience.
No question. Number two, Nutcracker in the Four Realms, $20 million. That's I think that's pretty impressive for a movie that nobody even knew.
It's actually pretty bad.
Oh, is it really? Well, they spent a lot of money on it, right?
As far as budget is concerned, the budget is somewhere between 120 and 133 million.
So,
$20 million start in the U.S. The movie's going to be lucky if it hits 60, 65 million, I think, here. And if it doesn't make, it's already made like another $38 million overseas, which I think is going to make a larger chunk of its money, obviously.
Right.
But if it doesn't make $100 million overseas, you're talking about another $100 million loser.
Yeah.
And Disney's had quite a few of these lately that don't involve like Marvel, Star Wars, or Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this year, Wrinkle in Time. This year, Alice Through the Looking Glass, Tomorrowland, there's a number of movies they try to make these. I don't know if they're going to franchise this thing, but it's a big special effects spectacular,
right?
And they spent a lot of money on it, and no one's really interested.
Yeah, the last one we'll talk about is the third one, Nobody's Fool, which is the latest Tyler Perry, Tiffany Haddish movie, $14 million. That's about right, right?
No. This is actually the third lowest opening in Tyler Perry's directorial career.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It's
exactly where I predicted it to be. I thought it was going to be kind of the low to mid-teens.
Yeah.
When I went over the list, it kind of surprised me that I thought there were a few more movies that did like around the $12-13 million range, but no, there's only a couple.
Well, do you think that this has something to do? My theory is that people are on Tiffany Haddish overload. That's because she's in everything.
I don't even know about that. I think it might just be the opposite, that Tiffany Haddish is not that big a star as people think she is.
Oh, okay.
I kind of go that way. And also on top of it, I think people are kind of over the Tyler Perry thing.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
That's a particular brand that shine bright for a while, but he's been when he doesn't put on the dress, the gross is not there.
Yeah. Well, so next week, what are we thinking? Is it going to be The Grinch? Will that be number one?
Yeah, The Grinch will be number one.
Okay.
I think very easily next week.
All right, cool. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
Okay.
All right, go listen to some Queen.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right, take care. Eric Childress, everybody, for box office and for movies, and we'll do it again next week. All right, let's take a break here on 720 W.